Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, Answering the Call. This is the fourth judge of Israel, Judges 4 and 5. Have you ever been asked to do something and you just kind of act like you didn't hear the person? Or maybe you just put it off and put it off, avoid, kind of just ignore them and hope that they won't keep bothering you. This is probably something that either we've all done or we've had done to us, right? When it's done to us, it's annoying. When we're doing it, we're hoping that it works. Generally, it doesn't. Usually, the person keeps nagging us, and eventually we give in anyway. The excuses don't work anymore. We get tired. Eventually we've got to do the thing that we're supposed to do in the first place, but just don't want to do. That's what I'm talking about. Not something that, you know, we just don't want to do that someone's asking us, but if we know we're supposed to do it and then we just keep putting it off, eventually we usually give in and do the right thing. So why don't we just do it in the first place, right? Why do we go through this whole mess of making excuses, avoiding, acting like we don't hear, acting like we can't do it yet, all of those things whenever we're just going to do it anyway, right? Well, that is what happens in our story today. Today, our judge is a woman, but she's not actually the person that does the deliverance of the Israelites, but she has to prompt the one who does. God calls Barak, but he doesn't want to go. And so he kind of just ignores it, acts like it's not happening. And Deborah has to come alongside him and say, hey, didn't God tell you to do something? You need to go do it. And so we'll just go ahead and get right to the passage. This is Judges 1, and it says, when Ehud, the last judge, died, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord again. And so the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, the king of Canaan. And so this was up in the north. There was a Jabin that we've heard of before, back in Joshua, when the people first came into the kingdom. If you remember, they fought all the southern tribes. And after they fought the southern tribes, Jabin, the king of Hazor, heard about this and he gathered all the northern tribes together so that maybe if they fought them together, they would win. And then what ended up happening there is they didn't win. And then the Israelites ended up burning Hazor and demolishing the rest of the cities. But we assume this is the same area, but just not the same person. Jabin is probably, since this was many years before with Joshua, Jabin is probably the title of the king and not the king's name himself. And so this king in the north of the Canaanites has been allowed to oppress the Israelites because the Israelites have done evil in the sight of the Lord, which reminds us again why they should have defeated all the people in the land in the first place, right? They did kill that king at that time, and they did kill all of the people living there, and they burned the city, but the people scattered, and they let them live in those places, and then they ended up going right back to their hometown, and nobody bothered with them. And this is the problem of them not doing what God told them to do in the first place. And so it says he had a commander of the army whose name was Sisera, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because Jabin had 900 iron chariots. So they were like, we can't do anything. God, please help us. And for 20 years, it says that they had harshly oppressed the Israelites. And then we hear about Deborah. So we know that they're being oppressed. And then there is this judge named Deborah. And Deborah as a judge here is more what we think of as a judge. It says she sits under the palm tree of Deborah, under her tree, and she makes judgments. People come to her and she, you know, judges between their cases, gives them wisdom, helps them make decisions. And note that this is a woman. And back in that day, that was really rare. But apparently they really respected her because they came to her from miles around to hear her judgments. It also says that Deborah was a prophetess. And the name prophetess has only been given to five women in the Old Testament. So this was very rare for God to use a woman as a prophet to speak through her to his people or allow her to speak to him on behalf of the people. That's what a prophet was, is kind of the mouthpiece for God and for the people, a go-between there. And Miriam was one of those prophetesses. She is the, sister of Moses. She was also called a prophetess. And then there were a few more, but this is very rare. But apparently people really respected her enough that when she sent for Barak all the way from Naphtali, she sat, her land was in the land of Ephraim, near Benjamin's land and near Judah's land. So in the south east of Ephraim's land is where she dwelt. And so she was close to those areas. Naphtali was in the north. That's where Barak lived. And she sent for him and he came, a man. So again, they must have all really respected her. And then this is what it says in verse 6. She says to Barak, "Has not the Lord of Israel commanded you, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor? Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and Zebulun, and against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariot and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand. Hasn't God said this to you?" And Barak doesn't really answer. He doesn't say, "Yeah, God told me this, but I didn't want to go." But it's pretty much implied because his response is, "I'll go if you'll go with me. If you're not going to come with me, though, I'm not going to go." So it's pretty apparent that God told him to do this, and he was just kind of acting like he didn't hear it. "I don't care to go. I don't want to go. And I'm comfortable in my land here." And he seems perfectly willing to let the people continue to live in oppression to the Canaanites, right? He doesn't even seem concerned about it, because if it requires him doing something, he's not willing. But then when he gets called out, he's like, "Fine, I'll do it, but only if you come with me." So first, he's reluctant to even obey God in the first place. And second, he needs her support to even do it. God's presence with him isn't enough, because God's already told him, "I'll make you victorious," but that isn't enough. He wants her presence. He needs somebody to hold his hand, right? He needs somebody to hold his hand. He's not going to do it otherwise. And providing that, she realizes he wasn't going to do it otherwise. She's like, "Fine, I'll go. But here's the catch. You won't get all the glory. If you don't want to take the responsibility for this battle, then you're not going to get all the glory for the battle." And so she says, this is verse 9. She says, "Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey that you are taking, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." So not only is he not going to be the one to kill the commander of the army, but it's not even going to be a soldier. It's going to be a woman that kills him. We find this out later. He doesn't know exactly how this is going to all play out, but she's saying the glory is going to go to someone else. And just to kind of add a little insult to injury, it's going to be a woman, you know. So this tough guy, this guy that's supposed to be a leader, he's supposed to take charge. This is what men are supposed to do. They're supposed to be the ones that go to war, protect the women and the children. This is an 8 in God's people. And he won't do it without the prompting of a woman. He won't do it without the hand-holding of a woman. And so she says, if that's the case, then a woman's also going to get the glory for this battle. And so it kind of, you know, should have prompted him to do what he should do by kind of insulting him. It's kind of saying, you know, someone that's supposed to not be doing these things that you're supposed to do for them instead, then they're going to do it. And so he goes, he takes the 10,000 troops from Zebulun and Naphtali as God has requested and goes along with Deborah, and they go to the place that he says, Mount Tabor. This is where Issachar, Zebulun, and Naphtali all kind of meet. This is right on the border of all of these places. He says, I want you to go there and wait, and then I will call Sisera out to you, and y'all will meet at the river Kishon. And the river Kishon is on the southern border of what would be Issachar's land, Zebulun's land, and then Asher's land, and then flowing into the Mediterranean Sea. And so this would be south of Mount Tabor, where they're going to be having the actual battle. But God says, go to Mount Tabor, and I'm going to draw him out to you. And so they do. They go out to Mount Tabor, and he draws Sisera to them. Sisera hears that they're there, this army of Israelites. He gets his 900 chariots and all of his army, and he sets out to meet them. So then, again, Deborah has to prompt Barak, and she says, hey, it's time for you to go. He is, you know, on his way to meet you. You need to get up and go meet him too. And then she encourages him and she says, God is going to go before you. Do not worry. Go ahead and go and fight these people. And so he does. He goes out to fight them. And we don't hear all of how God fights for them initially in this chapter, but in chapter 5, we'll get a little bit more details. But God drives them towards him, sends their horses into a panic, and they're fleeing what ends up being the flooding of the river. God floods the river. Like I say, we find that out here in a minute. And he floods the river and sends them into a panic. And the general, Sisera, hops off the back of one of the chariots and gets on foot and runs away. And leaves his soldiers there to fight. The Israelites completely defeat the soldiers. And then in verse 11, it just kind of veers off for a second. And it tells us about this random man named Heber. And it says that he was a descendant of Moses' brother-in-law. And he would have been with the tribe of the Kenites, but he has separated from them. And he's living all the way on the east, right by the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. And then it just kind of goes on with the story. So we're not exactly sure why he tells that, but we find out later that the reason they tell that story is because the general runs to his house. And it says he runs to his house because Heber has made peace with Jabin, the king. So he knows that this is a friendly place that he can run and get refuge from his enemy, or so he thinks. Well, Jael, his wife, she hears that she sees him coming. She knows who he is, and she says, hey, come in. I'll protect you. Come into the house. And so he comes into the house. And he says, hey, I'm thirsty. Can you give me some water to drink? She gives him a drink of milk, gives him a blanket, lets him lay down because he's tired. He's been running, you know, from his enemies and been in battle. He's tired. She gives him a blanket, lays him down, and he says, hey, will you keep watch at the door? And if anyone comes, don't let them know I'm here. And she's like, yeah, sure, no problem. And so he goes and lays down. And then I want you to listen to what they say she does to him. This is verse 21. Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and a hammer in her hand, and she went softly to him, and she drove the peg into his temple, and it went down into the ground. She drove it completely through his head into the ground as he's laying on the ground. This is what this woman has done. So, warrior, she's got courage, right? For sure. She's got strength. She's probably done this before, you know, putting the tent pegs in the ground, helping put the tent up. And so she has the strength to do this and the courage to go and do the thing that seemingly her husband wouldn't have done, because he ran to this house because the husband had made peace with the king. And so, you know, sometimes the men know what they're supposed to do. Sometimes us women know what we're supposed to do, but we don't do it. And in this story, the men know what they're supposed to do, but they either don't do it without the prompting of a woman, or they don't do it at all because, you know, they don't want to. They don't want to do the hard thing, the uncomfortable thing. And JL seems to realize, we should have never made peace with this king in the first place. And I need to take charge of this situation, do what is right here. And so both of these women have taken initiative where the men are sitting by passively, right? They're not taking charge. They're not leading. They're not doing the things that they need to do. They're not being soldiers without extreme prompting. And so, you know, when the leaders don't rise up, God will rise up another. When he calls you and you don't go, he will raise another. That's what he's done here. In their culture, and even innately in God's way, the men protect the women. The men are supposed to be the leaders, but they're not doing it. And the women are perfectly capable. It's not that women aren't, but women generally have different roles. They're the caretakers instead of the protectors, you know, things. They're the supporters of their husbands, not the leaders. That's how God set it up. He said, whenever he made Eve, he said, I should make a helper suitable for Adam, because I have these tasks that I'm asking Adam to do, and I want to make a helper for him. And so we're really not supposed to be the leaders. We're supposed to be supporting them. But, you know, sometimes it falls into kind of leadership. I mean, she's taken him by the hand. He does it, but she's taken him by the hand. And then again, like I say, they're usually, women are normally caretakers, not protectors in that same sense. But her husband has made peace with the king. And so she's like, I got this. I'm going to take care of it. And she's the one that kills the general. So very interesting. And then Barak comes looking for him. He's been chasing after Sisera. And turns out that JL meets him and she says, I know who you're looking for. Come here. He's right here. And she lets him into her tent, and there he is, dead, the general. She's killed him. Now, after this, Barak and Deborah, it says, sing a victory song. And that is what the chapter 5 is all about. And I'm not going to read it all to you. I'm going to kind of summarize it. If you get the study, or if you have your Bible and you want to look at it, it's a poetic song. And so some of the things are a little difficult to decipher. So I'm going to kind of go through it, but I'm not going to read every line and just kind of explain it to you. And so verse 2 says, when leaders lead in Israel, when people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. And that's not exactly what it says. In their poetic way, what the literal translation of that is, that when the long-haired men let their hair down, let loose their hair. That's the literal phrase. And that's just their poetic way of saying when the leaders lead, because the hair was supposed to be a sign of strength. You know, somebody that has healthy long hair looks like they're strong and healthy, right? And so this was a sign of strength. And it says, when they let loose their hair, when they let loose their strength, they defeated these people. That's what it's kind of saying in just a poetic way. And then they bless the Lord, and they go through and talk about how The heavens poured, the clouds poured water. So that's how we know that God was fighting on their behalf. God flooded the river, sent the chariots, on the run. And then it says the mountains gushed before God. So, the rivers are flowing high. And then it talks about, it says, in the days of Shamer and in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted and the travelers walked along the byways. And so what he's saying is that we couldn't live in safety. You know, when you don't feel comfortable going out and walking on the road, right? And that's what he's kind of saying. Remember, Shamer was the one who defeated the Philistines with the ox goad. And so he's saying, you know, we've had two people now in a row that were either the Philistines on the west coast or the Canaanites in the north that are living within our land that are oppressing us. And when they live right here and they're oppressing us, our normal way of life has been stunted. We haven't gotten to live normally, have a good life for a long time. And then it says, but then Deborah arose as a mother of Israel. So as a caregiver, as someone that is going to take care of the situation, Deborah arose to care for the people. She judged the people. She gave them wisdom, helped them with their decisions, and ultimately is the one who got Barak to do the thing that needed to be done to free the Israelites. And so it kind of praises her, and then it praises the soldiers and says they stepped up and they did what they needed to do. And now we have defeated all of these people. It says, my heart is with the rulers of Israel because they were willing to do this, go and fight for them. And then it talks about God again, and it talks about how he has taken control. He's done all of these things for them and given them this victory. And then it it praises the tribes that have joined in this battle. It sounds like it was just Nebulun and Naphtali, because he said, get 10,000 troops from them. But apparently, you know, I told you that Deborah was in the land of Ephraim, and that was very close to Benjamin's land. Well, apparently, those people traveled north with them. When Barak and Deborah traveled north, then the two tribes, men from those two tribes, traveled north with them. Also, this battle happened in Issachar's land. And so Issachar's men also dwelt with them. And so it praises all of those people. But then it calls out two tribes on the eastern side, on the western side of the Jordan. And all the tribes on the eastern side of the Jordan, the eastern side didn't even mess with it. Even though it was in the north, very close to Manasseh and Gad's land, they didn't bother to do anything with their brothers on the western side. And then even though Asher was right there, right next to the land of Zebulun, they didn't fight. Dan was as close to Hazor, the king of Jabin, as any of the rest of these people, and even closer than Ephraim and Benjamin were. And yet he didn't go out, the tribe of Dan. And so they call those people out. The only people they don't call out is Simeon and Judah, because they were too far south. Remember, they're the ones that have the V, the Negev down there. And they've got the whole southern portion, and then everybody else has the whole northern portion. And so it wouldn't make sense for them to go up into the land. It's kind of divided like that, north and south. And so they don't go up. And then the other people that don't go is the Levites, because they're not in service to the people through the army. They're in service to the Lord through, you know, their ministry. And so the Levites never do fight. So they don't call them out. And then after that, they talk about how God, you know, fought for them and made the horses gallop so fast away from the flood and all of that. And then it turns to Jael, and it gets even more graphic when it talks about Jael. First of all, it says that Sisera asks for water, yet she gives him milk. And it kind of gives the indication, you know, he's asking for water to quench his thirst, and milk is not satiating. You know, we know that milk doesn't really quench your thirst, not like water does. It kind of even makes you more thirsty. It's almost like food as opposed to a drink, even though it's wet. And so that's kind of her way of saying, you know, I'm not giving you what you want, and I'm actually going to kind of give you the opposite of what you want. But he doesn't seem to catch it, but they talk about that in this song. And then in verse 26, it says, she stretched her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer. She pounded Sisera. She pierced his head. She split and struck through his temple. At her feet, he sank. He fell, he lay still. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell, dead. So very graphic, right? Pounded his head, crushed his skull, basically, one of the versions says. And so it's praising her, obviously, and telling how she did this. And then the rest of the song is kind of sad, but they're happy about it, because these people are bad people. They've oppressed them for all this time. But the end of it talks about Sisera's mom. And listen to what it says. This is verse 28. The mother of Sisera looked through the window, and she cried out through the lattice, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarries the clatter of his chariots?" Her wisest ladies answered her. Yes, she answered herself. Are they not finding and dividing the spoils? To every man a girl or two? For Sisera plundered of dye garments, plundered of garments embroidered and dyed, 2 pieces of dyed embroidery for the neck of the looters. And so she is, you know, saying, why is it taking them so long to come back? Maybe he's dividing the spoils. Maybe he's dividing the women that they're going to take captive, maybe one or two each. Maybe they're going to get these beautiful clothes. Maybe the Israelites have a lot of stuff. And so that is why he is taking so long. And then obviously that's not the case, because her son chose the wrong enemy. And now he is defeated. He's not coming home. And the last part of the song says, thus all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let the ones that love you be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. So he says, strengthen our allies and defeat our enemies. That's what we're asking in the song. We praise you for, you know, this victory. And then the song is over. And then it says, everyone went back to their own lands, and they had peace for 40 years. So that is the lesson. What can we get from it? What can we learn? Well, one, when the people that are called to lead don't lead, then God will raise up another, right? But also, do you want somebody to call you out? Do you want somebody to hold your hand? Do you want someone to steal your glory? All because you put it off, you ignore it, you don't want to do the thing that God has asked you to do? I mean, have you ever felt God's calling on you, telling you to do something, either big or small? It could be, you know, that he's calling you to something huge, like a ministry of some sort, you know, a preacher or a teacher or a missionary, or, you know, to start some big organization or something like that. But it could be that you're not the leader of it. You just help somewhere, that you see a need and you're like, man, I could do that. And you feel like God calling you to do it, but you're like, I don't want to do that. That doesn't seem like any fun. You know, traveling to some foreign land, or, you know, helping some unfortunate person, or giving of my money or my time, or, you know, whatever the case may be. Maybe it's not something that we want to do. And so we hear that voice in the back of our head saying, you should do that. You should do that. And instead of doing it, you make an excuse. Oh, I'm not good enough. Oh, I can't do that. I don't have enough time. God isn't really telling you to do that, right? Surely that's someone else. That's just a stupid thought I had in my mind. I'm not going to be any good at that anyway. Whatever the case may be, right? But just like God did here with Barak, he went to somebody that was listening to him, right? Barak was ignoring him. So he said, well, you know, Deborah is a prophetess. She listens when I talk. I'll talk to her and she can talk to you on my behalf. And so God didn't stop. He did not stop. When he called Barak and Barak didn't answer, he just got somebody else to go to him and say, hey, you need to do this. And so I wonder if God is calling us to something. Yes, he can bring another to do it, no doubt. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But also, if this is a uniquely your task, I mean, there were tons of men and all of these men became soldiers and fought. Why did it have to be Barak? If Barak ignored him, why did God have to keep on with it? You know, well, for some reason, right? For some reason, God wanted him to do this. And God didn't stop until he said, okay. And so, you know, it makes you kind of wonder, is God going to do the same thing with us? Is he going to keep on nagging at you until you go ahead and do it? Is he going to keep putting it in your mind? Is he going to keep bringing other people to you? All of those kinds of things. I had this happen to me when my kids were young. My husband had just left for Afghanistan. I was already overwhelmed, but we needed a children's director at our church. And I kept seeing the you know, advertisement or the, you know, announcement for it. And I would love that job. And I thought that initially. I thought, oh, I would love to do that. That would be something that I would really be interested in. But then I thought, I don't have time for that. Am I really going to take on a part-time job, you know, in another town, you know, 20 minutes away? It wasn't far, but it was another town. And I'm like, am I really going to take on something extra whenever my husband is gone, my kids are young, and I'm already overwhelmed? And so I put it out of my head. Then the next Sunday rolled around and it comes, you know, I'm like, man, I would really love that, but it's just not the right time, whatever. And then I would think, you know, it's far away. And then I would think, oh, and then that person is in charge of VBS and they have to decorate for VBS. And I'm not a decorator. Like, I'm a teacher. I, you know, love children and I love the Bible, but I don't love, you know, decorating, and that's not my thing. And so, you know, they, like, I can't be that whole person, you know, maybe I'll just help with the kids, whatever. And so I just kept putting it out of my mind. But then the kids were going to camp. Somebody needed to fill out the forms and talk with the person and all of that. And so I kind of started doing some of that. And then I started having people come to me. No longer was it just in my head. People started saying, have you thought about doing this? You know, you already kind of doing some things. Have you thought about doing this? I'm like, yeah, I thought about it, but, and I start telling them all the things and they're like, you don't have to work here. You can work from home. We don't care. You don't have to drive up here all the time. And I'm like, oh, well, that helps. And then I'll tell them about the VBS and they're like, you don't have to decorate. You just have to get someone to decorate. You just have to make sure that it gets done. I'm like, okay. And so over and over until finally I'm like, okay, this is God. God is telling me to do this. This isn't just something in my head that it's like, oh, I'd enjoy that, but it's not working. And so God kept prompting me until I did it. And I loved that job. And I did it until it just wasn't viable anymore for me to do. And so I want to tell you two stories about people that he called in the Bible. One is Jonah. You might know this story, but God has called Jonah to go to Nineveh, which is an evil town where bad people are. Jonah does not like these people. And God says, go and preach repentance to them. Tell them that they're going against me and that I'm going to kill them if they don't straighten up. But if they will, then I'll spare their lives. And Jonah's like, I don't want their lives spared. They're horrible people. I want them all to die. I'm not going. And so Jonah gets on a boat, goes the opposite direction of the place that God told him to go. I mean, very defiant, right? And God sends a storm. The boat is about to capsize. Jonah knows somehow that the storm is set for him. He finally convinces the other people to throw him overboard so that the storm will stop. He's like, we're either all going to die or I'm going to die. They're reluctant, but they do it. They throw him overboard. And then God gets a big fish to swallow Jonah whole. He can't even die to to get out of his calling. God is like, no, you're not going to get out of it that easy, which doesn't even seem easy, right? He says, you're going to Nineveh. So he has him in the belly of this fish. Finally, Jonah repents of his own sin. And then God has the fish spit him out on shore, so he's safe. And God tells him again, now go to Nineveh. And so finally he's like, apparently I have no choice. I am not getting out of this. I have to go to Nineveh. He kicks and screams kind of the whole time, but he does it. And so that's one person. It's like, if you're going to do it anyway, don't go through all the trouble. You know, if God is going to ask you to do something, why are we resisting God? You know, is not his will going to be done eventually, right? But he does. And then Esther is another person. And Esther isn't resistant because she's rebellious. She isn't resistant because she doesn't want to do the thing necessarily God asked her to do. But she's scared. There has been a edict handed down to say that all of the Jews will be killed in the land. Evil official has come to the king and kind of coerced him. Well, the king doesn't know that Esther, his wife, is a Jew. She's hidden this from him this whole time. And so her uncle comes to her and he says, hey, you need to go to the king and you need to put a stop to this. And she says, I can't go to the king unless I'm summoned. If I do, then he has the right to kill me. The king has to give me permission once I get in there to say either, yes, I can come to him or kill me. And Mordecai, her uncle, says to her, do you really think you'll escape if this edict stands? Do you really think that you have a choice? You want to sit idly by and hope that you escape? It's not going to happen. And so you're going to sit and not do anything out of fear, and then you're going to get killed anyway, but all the people are going to get killed with you. And so he says, you don't really have a choice. Sometimes God makes it just that blunt. He's like, you don't have a choice. You will do this thing that you're called to do. And Mordecai says, how do you know that you haven't been put in this position to be this man's queen for this exact purpose? How do you know that that's not the case? And she says, you're right. That probably is why I, a Jew, am his wife. And so she says, okay, y'all pray and fast and I'll go to him. And so she does. And so, and then she does save them. It's a great book if you haven't read it. We'll get to it actually in not very long. I think we'll get to the book of Esther, but it's only 10 chapters. So you should read it if you haven't. It's so good. But anyway, you know, God oftentimes does kind of make us do the thing. And so if he's going to make us do the thing, don't go through the kicking and screaming, the making excuses, the feeling guilty for not doing it and all of that. And I'm not talking about, you know, genuinely not knowing. I genuinely didn't know if God was wanting me to be the children's director or not. And I was definitely open to it, but I also wanted to do it. So what happens when you don't want to do it, right? And so we don't want to be those people. We don't want to be the people that somebody has to call us out and say, didn't God tell you to do this, but you don't want to? Yeah, you should do that. You don't want to be in that position, right? And so God's ways are probably going to happen one way or the other. Either God's going to force us to do it, not probably, will. Either God's going to make sure that we follow through with our calling, or he's going to call somebody else. And so Proverbs 19:21 says, many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand. So you might have a plan, but God's ways are going to be the ones that happen. And so we have to remember that whatever God has called us to, he's equipped us for, right? He will enable us to be successful if it's his will for us to do it. Hebrews 13:20-21 says, now may the God of peace, who brought up from the dead the great shepherd of the sheep through the blood of the eternal covenant, that is Jesus our Lord, may that God equip you in every good thing to do his will. May he equip you to do his will, working in us that which is pleasing in his sight through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory forever. and ever. Amen. And so he can accomplish it through someone else, and he might if we don't do it, but he wants us to do it. He can equip us to do this thing that he's called us to do, and he wants us to do it because there are blessings that come with obeying him. Now, we don't want to manipulate him into giving us blessings, because we can't do that anyway. He knows our heart. And we don't want to do good things so that we get accolades from men. But we do know, we have the comfort of knowing we're not doing it for the purpose of the blessings. But when we're scared or we feel inadequate or it is uncomfortable or whatever, we have the comfort of knowing that God is with us and there's going to be benefit to us in some way for doing this thing. Even Jesus says it's more blessed to give than to receive, right? It's blessed to minister, to serve, to do the things that God has asked us to do. We're made to do service for him. That is what we're created for. Ephesians 2:10 says, we are his workmanship, created in Christ for good works. It's what we're made for, made to do good works that God has prepared beforehand so that we can walk in them. God will prepare the way for us, but we are supposed to do those things. It's what we're created to do. Not to mention that we owe him, right? I've quoted this verse a million times because I always am just feeling like we are indebted to him. He died for us. He came, he left heaven, the perfect, glorious place, to come to this earth and live, to show us how to live, to explain things to us, to bring us ultimately salvation through his sacrifice. And so how can we not live for him? 2 Corinthians 5:15, he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and rose again. What better verse, right, with this Easter weekend coming up? Jesus died and rose for us, so we should live for him. We're indebted to him. How can we say no to someone that, if you think about Jesus as a person who has given the greatest sacrifice that a person could give, like just think about anything that a person could do for you right now, anything that you might need, money, protection, help in some way, whatever it is that you might need, and the person gives it to you abundantly, the greatest sacrifice that they could ever do and the best gift that you could ever have, and they did that for you, are you not indebted to them? It's like somehow we don't look at Jesus as a person, but he was a person that did this thing for us, so why can we not live for him, right? And then, could God not have unilaterally freed the Israelites? Why did he need Barak, right? Well, he doesn't need him. He wants us. He can do everything without us, but then that would not be a relationship, right? He doesn't want to be a king sitting on his throne, handing down edicts and not having any relationship with his people. That is not the kind of God that we serve. He wants to work together with us. He wants to work in tandem with his people because he wants a relationship, a partnership where we work together to accomplish his goals. That is what Christian life is supposed to be like. Now we're supposed to have joined his team and we want to work for him, with him, together on his goals. That is our job. We're supposed to be his hands and feet and his mouth, right? We're supposed to be doing the things here on this earth for him. Romans 10:14-18 says, how then shall they call on him whom they haven't believed? And how can they believe in the one that they haven't heard about? How shall they hear without a preacher? How shall they preach unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. That is the Apostle Paul quoting the Old Testament. It's when it says, as it is written, how beautiful are the feet. It says, but they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our report? So then faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. But I say, have they not heard? Yes, indeed, their sound has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. That's our job, to go out, to walk to these places, to speak the gospel to others, to be his hands and feet, to do the ministry. That's our job. God wants that from us. We don't want to have to be called out by another to do what it is that God has asked us to do. And we also don't want to put stipulations on our obedience. Now, Barak also did that. He said, I'm not going to obey God unless you come with me, Deborah. That is not how we're supposed to obey. If we're afraid, we shouldn't have to have someone else come with us. We should trust in the Lord. God was going to go before him and help him, but that wasn't enough. He needed someone else. It's like, I'll do it if you send someone else. I'll do it if this or that. If we're afraid, we just need to have faith in God. So there was a story in the New Testament, in the Gospels, where it tells the story about Jesus being tired and not getting on the boat with the disciples, and then the disciples being out in the boat in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus walking on water to them. And they see him and they're scared and they think he's a ghost. And he said, Hey, I'm not a ghost. I am, your teacher, Jesus. And, Peter says, call out to me and I'll come to you. I want to walk on the water too. And Jesus says, come to me. And he starts and he walks for a little while, but then he realizes what's happening, right? And he's like, oh my gosh, I'm walking on water. What in the world is happening? And he takes his eyes off of Jesus and he begins to sink. And Jesus says to him, oh, ye of little faith, you know, you didn't have enough faith to keep walking. So if we are scared, we just need to have faith in God. Don't doubt that he can do all things. If we're willing, he is able, right? We don't have to worry about that. Isaiah 6, 1 through 8 talks about Isaiah sees this vision and he sees the seraphim and God on the throne. And he says, you know, I'm inadequate. I can't do see you. Like, I'm a man of unclean lips. And they take the coal and they touch his lips with it. And it says, you know, we have made your lips clean now. And then it says he heard a person saying, whom shall we send? And Isaiah said, here I am, send me. So if we're willing, God is able. We can trust him. And we don't have to be feeling inadequate either, because like I told you, he will equip you. If you're thinking, I can't do this because I'm not a decorator, right? I can't do this. This isn't my thing. I'm not equipped for this job. God says, I'll either equip you or I'll send someone to help you. You don't have to worry about this. Moses did this when God came to Moses and he says, hey, I want you to go to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. And Moses says, God, I'm not an eloquent man, neither before you came to me or since. I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. I can't do this. And you know what Jesus said? He said, who made man's mouth? Who makes a person mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Isn't it me? He's basically saying, yeah, I know you don't have good speech. I made you like that. And I'm still calling you to do it. So if God calls us to do something that we don't feel that we're equipped to do, we can know that he will equip us. He knows our strengths and our weaknesses, and he still called us, right? He could have called someone else that is eloquent of speech. That would have made sense. But he said, no, I want you, Moses. And he does the same thing with us. There are things that we're not going to be great at. We can't be good at everything. We're only human. And sometimes we may think, yeah, God, you should send someone else that's better at this. But God says, no, I chose you. I knew you weren't good at that when I chose you, and I still chose you. So go do it. I'll take care of the things that you aren't good at. So we need to trust him. We are supposed to work together with other believers to accomplish his goals here on this earth. And there are other people in the world that are better at certain things than us, and God has called them to it. And so this is Romans 12, 4 through 8. It says, "For as we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another." So he's talking about how, you know, there's another verse where he says, you know, a hand isn't a foot. He's talking about that physical body and then comparing it to the body of the church. And so here he says, having gifts differing according to the grace that's been given to us, let us use them. Let us use our gifts. If our gift is prophesying, then we should prophesy in proportion to our faith. If it's ministry, let us minister. If it's teaching, then teach. He who is good at exhorting, at encouraging, then encourage. He who gives, give liberally. He who is a leader, be diligent. And he who shows mercy, do it with cheerfulness. Whatever it is that God's called you to do, it might just be being a cheerful, you know, encourager. That might be your calling. Doesn't have to be some big ministry. It does not have to be. It might be that you are good at praying for people. It might be that you are the person that brings the food or organizes the food. You're good at hospitality. Another thing that I am not good at, right? These are things that we can do. And so we just need to be willing and we need to listen when God calls us. Don't be that person that has to be called out by someone else. Don't be the person that has to be nagged. I used to tell my kids, if you don't want me to tell you 50 times, then do it the first time, right? Don't go through it. Don't be that person that is sitting by passively. Know that God has a purpose for you in His kingdom. We're made to serve Him. And so ask Him, what do you want me to do? And listen when He talks. You know, hear the still small whisper so he doesn't have to scream. This is our goal. So this is what we can learn from Barak and Deborah and Jael, what a courageous woman, right? And then next week we will talk about the next judge. So join me next week. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss that episode. Join me on social media. I'll post verses and clips from this. And then also join me on Substack, livethroughjesus.substack.com. You can get blog posts there for free. And then if you want the written lesson that I'm doing here, you'll have to pay for that, $6 a month or $60 a year. Cancel anytime. And you can also go to livethroughjesus.com. You can get all of the links to the podcast, the YouTube channel, and a free blog post there also. So lots of opportunities for y'all. Thanks. I'll see you back next week.